I believe that it will be central to medicine if we have the desire and ability and courage to be able to make the changes that are needed in how we finance health systems, how we organize health systems, and how we evaluate them.
Welcome to the Business of AI in Healthcare podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Bob Kaiser. Our mission is to discuss practical insights and share knowledge on how to navigate the transformative technology of AI. It's important to understand how AI can be used safely and ethically while revolutionizing patient care, streamlining operations, and enhancing medical research. He's the best-selling author of Mistreated, Why We Think We're Getting Good Healthcare and Why We're Usually Wrong, and Uncaring, How the Culture of Medicine Kills Doctors and Patients. His latest book, ChatGPT MD, How AI-Empowered Patients and Doctors Can Take Back Control of American Medicine, explores the groundbreaking potential of artificial intelligence in medicine and the future of healthcare delivery. With a background as a surgeon and decades of experience at the helm of one of the largest medical groups in the country, his insights on the intersection of medicine, leadership, and technology are unparalleled. Dr. Robert Pearl, welcome to the Business of AI and Healthcare podcast.
Bob, it's a great pleasure to be with you today.
I should have said, Robbie, welcome to the podcast, since I know you encourage less formality. So I'm going to call you Robbie going forward.
That'd be great. Thank you.
There are so many dimensions to ChatGPT MD, and some of the topics, they go way beyond the prevailing technology of generative AI. I want to have some warm-up discussion topics to start with and then get into a few of the major insights of the book. So, Robbie, please share with our audience the motivating moment that inspired your third book. You were preparing for a course you teach at Stanford. Take it from there.
In the book, I talk about the what's called Porter's Five Forces. This is a way to understand an industry. In the middle, you could think of the insurance companies competing with each other. And on the horizontal axis, you have the payers, the government, businesses and individuals, and the providers. These are hospitals and doctors and drug companies. And this is the usual axis of competition in most industries, and has been in healthcare for a long time. But then you have a vertical axis, and this includes new entrants and substitutes. And my realization as I was preparing for this year was recognizing that the new entrants and substitutes, particularly those inside generative AI, would be so much more significant than the longstanding traditional values. Phrased differently, in the usual negotiations, we're talking about changing healthcare by 1% or 2%. Mm-hmm. Generative AI has a potential to save hundreds of thousands of lives and actually to lower the cost of healthcare, not by skimping, but by being able to avoid the complications of chronic disease, heart attacks, strokes, kidney failure, cancer. And in that way, it becomes the endpoint, what we call value-based care, and that new world is dawning today.
We are living now in a time of exponential growth, and people don't understand that. And most people, they're unaware of the future, how fast it's coming and the changes that are coming. And most of us are still unaware of artificial intelligence or AI. But you give an example of lily pads growing in a pond. Please explain how this relates to technology.
What we know is that generative AI is doubling in power every year. And we think about that as being a rapid change. What we don't realize is how big it is. It's the equivalent of your car in 5 years going as fast as an airplane and in a decade as fast as a rocket ship. We're talking about a technology that today is very powerful and will be 32 times more powerful in 5 years and 1,000 times in 10 years.
Wow.
The pond analogy is very simple. You have a lake with one lily pod and each lily plant, and each night it's going to double and its progeny are going to double. And after 50 days, the whole lake's going to be covered. And day 43, you and I walk out there, we look at it, and I say, Bob, this is going to be totally covered. You say, wait a second. It's like maybe 1% of this lake is green. There's no way it's going to be covered in 7 more days. And that is what the math does. And our brains just can't comprehend it. You know, I think back to 2007. My dad knew that I've always been interested in technology. And he called me so excited in 2007. I remember the phone call. He said, I just got an iPhone. And I said, Dad, that is amazing. What are you going to do with it? He said, oh, I'm going to lock it in my trunk. And if I get into an accident, I'll have a way to get help. That was the most he could see. And most people could see it. Of course, today, it's in every part of our life. The same thing is going to be true of generative AI. The critics of it today are looking at what exists right now. This is going to be a toy compared to what we're going to see, as I say, in a mere 5 years. And that's what makes it very different than almost any technological advance that I've witnessed over my career.
So we're waking up. We need to wake up fairly quickly here. I remember another story of taking a grain of rice and putting it on a chessboard and doubling that, every piece of the chessboard. And at chessboard number 55, you had all the rice that was ever grown in the world. That's incredible. So we need to tune ourselves into this fact that things are happening very quickly. And we're burning daylight. Is that why you teamed up with ChatGPT as your co-author? What did it take to establish a working relationship with something like ChatGPT? How'd you do that?
Yeah. Well, this book really came out of a recognition that we finally had the tool that we needed. As you said, my first books, Mistreated, looked at the problems with the system of medicine. We had Uncaring, that was the culture of medicine. I think what we've never had is really going to be the tool that could make that change. And finally, it just appears out of nowhere, seemingly. OpenAI releases it in November of 2022. So now we finally have a tool that is capable of making these changes. And I wanted to write a book about its potential. I thought the best way to write it would be to co-author with the tool, show how it could impact every part of our life, including the creative one. So I approach it the way I do with a medical student or a resident, asking it to create drafts, or I create drafts, edited back and forth, exchanged ideas. And so that was the derivative of it. I also wanted to see some of the challenges. And the book has 30-page bibliography because I fact-checked everything that AI said. And I did find one example of a hallucination where it envisioned that we explorers had gone to the North Pole and had a whole piece about leadership. I couldn't find any evidence that it exists. If listeners can find it, please let me know so I can apologize to ChatGPT. But I wanted to be able to see what it could do. And it was remarkable. As I said, that was the early draft of the ChatGPT-4. And 5 is going to come out soon, and we have 4.0 already, which allows people not just to enter information by typing, but by speaking and to see images. We're going to see an explosion, as you said earlier, that our minds can't yet grasp.
It took you 3 years to do your first book, and I think another couple, 2 or 3 years to do the second book. If you'd waited 2 or 3 years to get this book out, I think it'd probably be obsolete, wouldn't it?
Absolutely. There's no question about it. In fact, the book's been out 6 months, and I'll remind listeners that all the profits go to Doctors Without Borders, a wonderful charity. It's been 6 months, and already I would say the number of use case applications has doubled. So it may not be a full year till we see this increase in power. It's happening so fast. So you're absolutely right. I was able to write the book in less time, and I was able to get it published even quicker.
In different parts of the book, ChatGPT makes commentary about you. How did you train ChatGPT to know about Robbie?
So I started by taking the 1.2 million words that I have published across time and entered it into the application, which at the time was difficult. Today would be far less so because there's what's called GPTs, called plugins, that would now allow you to do it that didn't exist at the time. And I did include a couple of sections where I would say, and by that I mean a couple of pages, maybe six in total, where ChatGPT wrote 90-95% of the material, just to let readers see what was possible. Everything else I say was an iterative way, the way that I would write with a medical student or a resident. At the end of the day, I can't be sure who wrote exactly what, because it's gone through so many edits and revisions. So that was the idea. Again, as much I wanted to demonstrate what this tool could do as be able to use it, I would say in the end, I probably spent as much time writing this book as I did the others, but I think this is the best of the three.
You know, you established a delineation of healthcare in the book, and you refer to healthcare 1.0, 2.0, and 3.0, which is now being followed by healthcare 4.0. So we could spend a lot of time going into each of those, but without great detail, why don't you share the timeline of these categories and actually what they represent?
So to me, healthcare 1.0 was the advances made in the, I'll call it the latter half of the 20th century. We're talking about CT, MRI, cardiac surgery, transplantation. You know, I had a cousin who died. I wrote about him in a previous book from Hodgkin's disease. And the treatment that he received at the time was the best we had, but now the disease is completely different, or AIDS, HIV. You're looking at a disease that is now a chronic illness. People live an entire lifetime. It used to be 100% lethal in a relatively short amount of time. So we saw these advances in 1.0. 2.0 was the introduction of the electronic health record. This promised remarkable improvements. It promised to be able to have comprehensive information at the fingertips of every doctor to help minimize the likelihood of medical errors and misdiagnoses, because it could counsel you in advance with prompts that were built into the system. But instead, it failed. 1.0 was a tremendous success. Life expectancy increased dramatically. Fulfillment, satisfaction went up. 2.0, I think, was a moderate failure. Physicians found the computer to sit between them and the patient. Information still is not comprehensive or available. It's not the technology. It's the companies that have the technology that don't want their price position and current competitive situation to be undermined. Then 3.0 came. This was the internet. This was going to be the Amazon in healthcare. You could email your doctor. You could text your physician. You could make your own appointments. You could do the things in medicine that you do, whether you're booking an airline flight, whether you're booking a hotel, whether you want to get a dinner reservation. It doesn't really matter. We have these tools, and again, it failed. And my conclusion out of that was two things. Number one, any technology like the electronic health record that slows clinicians down isn't going to be embraced. And number two, any technology like many of the internet ones that would undermine the income of clinicians was also not going to be embraced. And so I put a lot of that into my thinking about generative AI and how can we use that in ways that, rather than undermining income and taking more time, it actually makes the day-to-day life of the clinician easier and preserves and offers opportunity to increase the reimbursement that they receive.
I think that gives us a really good perspective, and that's very important. So let's work our way into a little bit more detail into an AI discussion. You indicate that the use of the word AI is not interchangeable. Why don't you start with rules-based AI and provide a little history of AI working up to generative AI?
I think that the word, or the two letters, but we use it as a word, AI, is one that we should stop using. Because although there's commonality, there is more difference than sameness within the different, as you say, three eras. So the first one, a rules-based, that happened around 1980. It actually happened at Stanford, where I teach in the medical and business school. And it was the introduction of this rules-based AI technology to help clinicians know the right antibiotic to prescribe for a particular infectious disease. The way a rules-based systems work is you find an expert and you have that individual provide the rules that medical practice uses to reach a diagnosis or to recommend a treatment. As you know, we use what's called heuristics. These are rules of thumb. Look at a pathology slide and we see that cells are dividing. We see that nuclei are in strange configurations. We see that the tissue is invading, not just pushing the soft tissues around it away. We call that cancer. Maybe 3, 4, 5, 6 different little heuristics, rules of thumb that we use to make the right diagnosis, to recommend the right treatment. The challenge of a rules-based AI is it can never be as good as the person who creates it. Why is that? Because we know that with experience, we get better. Yes, we memorize the rules in medical school and residency, but over time, we've seen enough patients with a similar problem that we can do better than those rules of thumb. How we do it, we're not quite sure. We call it intuition, but that is the path that it is on. Come 2000, it all changes. Biology actually starts to impact thinking. We have neural nets and neural networks and different layers of understanding, interconnections that sit in place. And now what we do is, rather than entering rules, we take two large data sets and ask the technology to compare, find differences, and to assign a probability factor to each. A classic example is mammograms. These are very hard to interpret. Take two experienced mammographers, give them the same series of films, and they will disagree 20% of the time. That's a lot of disagreement around what is cancer and what is not cancer. So if you give the machine 10,000 mammograms, 5,000 show cancer, 5,000 are either benign or have either benign disease or normal, and it finds 60, 70, 80 differences, assigns a probability factor. We don't even know all these differences. We probably couldn't see them with our eyes or be able to understand them with our brains, but the machine can. And out of that, it becomes 10% better than a clinician. All of these have to be FDA approved. There's almost 1,000 now. And they tend to be about 10% better than humans. What's the challenge? And why today is there so little use of these actually in clinical medicine? The answer is that the narrow AI is, as it says, it's narrow. The mammogram can't read chest x-rays or brain scans. And the second thing that we know about it is that we need, therefore, to have 10,000 generative AI programs. And finally, it's only as good as the accuracy of the data set. It's why almost all the applications are for visual, dermatology, retinal scans and ophthalmology, radiology, pathology. It's not particularly useful off of data coming from the electronic health record. Because as we know, there's a lot of errors built into the electronic health record. If you see a patient, you say their pain is 6 on a scale of 10, and I see a patient, I say it's 7 on 10. Is my patient in more pain than yours? We have no idea. And yet that fact is not, or the relativity of that fact is not understood by the machine. It assumes that there's an objective measure that sits there. All of a sudden, a year and a half ago, OpenAI releases generative AI. Generative AI is completely different. I like ChatGPT MD because it flows nicely, but in some ways, instead of being GPT, it should be PTG. We don't give it any data sets to look at. We provide the totality of everything available on the internet. It has every textbook, every journal article embedded into it. That's the P, the pre-training. And once it's pre-trained on that, as well as the vast corpus of information on science in general, psychology, all the different aspects, we then do the T, right? We transform it. We use what's called parameters, 2 billion rules about how you relate data to itself. Articles published more recently are perceived to be better than previous ones, ones from that are peer-reviewed, better than ones that are not, ones out of academic centers, better than ones coming out of just some other institution that doesn't have the academic stature. Now, are those rules always correct? No, but they self-correct. By the time you combine them all together, you get a better understanding, and that allows this large language model to then generate an answer just about to any question you want to pose. So this is why I differentiate them. And unlike a narrow AI tool, a generative AI tool, I don't think can really be regulated. It's like a telephone. You can get great advice or bad advice over the telephone, but you can't regulate the telephone for the advice that someone gives you. You can regulate to make sure it doesn't catch on fire or explode or something else. You can't regulate how people are going to use this technology. As you said, I've been on a lot of podcasts. One of the ones I was on early in the season, an interviewer asked me about her husband at the end of the show. We were off air. She said, my husband fell. He was skiing 3 months ago. His arm was over his head. He slid down 100 feet. And his shoulder still hurts, and he can't use it as well as the other side. You're a skier. You're a doctor. What do you think is going on? I said, you know, I think I know exactly what's going on. But on the show today, you said you'd never use generative AI. Why don't you go use it? Put the information in place and just see the answer you get. And then give me a call back, and I'll tell you what I think is going on. 5 days later, she calls me back. She said, the generative AI tool told me, number one, that it was probably a torn rotator cuff. Mm-hmm. Number two, that he needed to have an MRI. And three, he needed to see an orthopedic surgeon because his injury probably required surgery. Now compare that to just going on a search engine like Google. You'd get a differential diagnosis of 100 items for shoulder pain. You know, you'd get a different 100 reasons why arms don't work as well as the other side. You'd get told to see an orthopedic surgeon, not because your case required it, but because it protects the person giving the advice. This is specific. It's expertise. And she said that he had the study done. It was the torn cuff. And the surgeon said, if you'd waited 3 more months, I probably could not have gotten the muscle, the tendon attached to the muscle, reattached because the muscle would have contracted. That is the importance and why the book is talks about the AI-empowered patient first and then AI-empowered clinician.
So with Google, you might get knowledge, but with Gen AI, you'll get expertise.
Yes.
Okay. Well, as I read and listened to the book, and I heard you talk about Gen AI, I felt like there's nothing it can't do if doctors were willing to see the future value, trying to get doctors to understand this. And, you know, the book, you subtitle it, How AI Empowered Patients and Doctors Can Take Back Control of American Medicine. Let's start with the chronic care epidemic. And I'll warn everybody right now, this could be a full course lecture. But let's talk about the chronic care epidemic, Robbie.
We've seen an explosion in chronic disease. I actually believe it is the driver of almost everything that is problematic in American healthcare today, from the cost, from the fact that we're seeing languishing outcomes with our life expectancy being flat since 2010. I think it accounts for a lot of the burnout that clinicians are feeling because the demands are so great. Now, what we know, the CDC has said that if we could effectively manage chronic disease as well as people do, not some theoretical perfection, just, you know, when I was CEO in Kaiser Permanente, we did a really good job. As an example, hypertension, the number one cause of strokes. We had rates of good control over 90%. The rest of the nation, 55 to 60. Wow. That gap is massive when it comes to strokes and heart attacks and kidney failure. Diabetes is another good example. Across the nation today, we control 30% of the time. Now, it's not as though we don't know how to do it. And I say that because at Stanford, where I teach, the engineering school, you can walk over there, and they have these, they look like Band-Aids. They're monitors. They monitor blood pressure, pulse, blood glucose, blood oxygen. You go down a whole list of items. We can manage it now. How about accuracy? It's about 99.9% reliable. They are terrific. Why can I not find a single doctor who's using these with their patients? Because no one wants that information, even though it's really valuable. Why do I say that? You know, if you're a patient, you went to your physician, they diagnosed hypertension, they start you on a medication, and you wear a device for a month, 3 measurements a day. You have 100 at the end of the month. 92 are normal, 8 are abnormal. How are you doing? I'm doing great. I got 92 normal. I'm doing terribly. I have 8 abnormal. You can't figure it out. And there's no doctor who wants to have 100 blood pressure measurements given. For a Gen AI application, this is simple. It's a simple mathematical calculation because you can follow the first and second derivatives, see where it's going. And if after a month, it's still going in the wrong direction, you need to have medication changed. What do we do in practice today? We say, see in 4 months. In 4 months, you come back, it's still elevated. What do we say? White coat syndrome. Come back in 4 more months. The reason we don't control it is not that we don't have the medications or the know-how. We just don't do the things that we're capable of. And that's where I see a tremendous potential for this. And as I say, think about, ask yourself, if heart attack, strokes, kidney failure, and cancers were reduced 30 to 50%, we'd save hundreds of thousands of lives. We'd increase health in this nation, and we'd lower costs dramatically, and yet we don't do that. That's, I'd say, the opportunity that exists. The challenge is that in the system that we have today, a fee-for-service type system of medicine, the preventive and better controlled management of chronic disease is undervalued. You know, doctors are busy. They're seeing patients every 17 minutes. They barely have time to take care of the acute problems that exist. They usually end up skipping over these kinds of chronic, underlying, preventive disease. We value intervention and we minimize the ability to be able to avoid the problems in the first place. And that has major costs. And it also diminishes our success at being able to achieve good control of chronic disease and avoid the complications. But we could change that. If we move from fee-for-service, a pay-for-volume, you get paid twice as much for seeing a patient twice, even if you could have solved it the first time. You get paid for doing two procedures when one would work. If we could actually do the things that we know could happen, and move from fee-for-service to capitation. A single payment at the delivery system level. I want to stress that, not to the insurer, but to doctors and hospitals working together as one so that they can share in the reward. We now align all the incentives. Charlie Munger, the Warren Buffett's assistant, said, tell me your incentives and I'll tell you the outcomes you're going to get. Design a system that rewards you for doing more, you get high volume. We design a system that rewards you for doing better and you'll get better outcomes. I mean, think about it this way. 400,000 people die annually from misdiagnoses. 250,000 die annually from medical errors. We know there's a massive amount of opportunity in the chronic disease area, both to prevent and better manage these diseases. We are not doing a great job, even though we have a great healthcare system, maybe even the best in the world at taking care of you once you have the heart attack or the stroke or the cancer. But we could have outcomes that were twice as good, three times as good, if we could have the same level of expertise preventing it. And this is where the triad of an empowered patient, a dedicated clinician, and Gen AI can outperform, I believe, any of the three alone. And by 5 years from now, it won't even be a contest.
Okay, so we're thinking about this fee for service. You know, that's a transactional reimbursement. And an alternative to that is something called capitation. So why don't you share with our audience what capitation is and why this direction is so important to start to target?
Capitation takes a group of patients. It's not a single patient. So you capitate, let's say, 100,000 individuals. And you capitate, meaning that you pay a single fee to a group of clinicians, hopefully clinicians associated with a particular hospital, to take care of these patients. So now we've created an alignment of incentives. If you're able to prevent disease rather than simply treating it, costs go down, your patient does well, and you do well. Create a way in which you avoid a misdiagnosis leading to a second or third procedure. You do well, your patient does well. Diagnose colon cancer before it spreads. Once it spreads, it's $200,000 of chemotherapy, and life expectancy drops significantly. Every place that I look, what I see is that if we can align these incentives by a capitated payment model. Now, what happens today? Because a lot of your listeners are very educated and they understand that capitation has been tried for a while and hasn't always worked. We capitate at the insurance level. And then the insurance company pays the doctors and the hospitals fee for service. That can't work. And that's why when it doesn't work, what do the insurance companies do? Prior authorization, because that's how the only way they can lower the cost. And how do doctors respond? They just do higher volume. And we get into this vicious cycle. Capitation at the delivery system level would allow us to have a virtuous cycle where essentially you keep people healthier, it generates added dollars. Those dollars can be invested back into preventive services, can be invested in helping people address some of the social determinants of health, address the ways that could be better diet, better exercise, less social isolation. All of a sudden, it's a flywheel that spins faster and faster. You've aligned all your incentives and you get a great outcome. And generative AI, I think, will be the tool that really makes it possible. It's going to allow people to be able to figure out a better diet, figure out an exercise program, be able to understand whether their symptoms are significant or not, better manage their chronic disease at the clinician level. It's going to allow clinicians to minimize making a medical error. There's a surgeon friend of mine who was in the operating room. She had just done a very complex neck procedure. And the anesthesiologist said that the vocal cords, rather than being separated as they should be, were tightly together. And if the anesthesiologist took out the breathing tube, they would block the airway, the patient would die. Well, she knew that she hadn't damaged any of the nerves to the larynx, to the vocal cords. She couldn't figure out what was going on, pulled out her phone, went to generative AI, found four cases of exactly the same thing. They found out was that it was the anesthetic diffuses too quickly. And as a result of that, if you wait 30 minutes, it all gets back to normal. And rather than the patient going to the ICU or having a tracheostomy, patient was able to go home. That is the opportunity that generative AI has. Better for patients, better for clinicians.
So Medicare Advantage, it's a captivated option right now for us that are over 65. How do you see these large retailers like Amazon and Apple, Walmart? How do they look at captivation model for disruption?
Sure. So in terms of the current Medicare Advantage, that's capitated at the insurance level.
Yes.
Our listeners understand. But they're often paying the clinicians at the fee for service. Why it has not actually delivered, I don't think, in general, there are exceptions. ChenMed's a great exception, remarkable outcomes. Kaiser Permanente has also done really well, lowering the chances of patients dying from heart disease and from strokes and cancers by 30%, 40%, and a lot of cases depending upon the specific area that you are looking. So that is the big opportunity, I think, that's sits there with the capitated methodology. How does it work? You bring a group of clinicians together, and rather than everyone doing their own thing, they actually talk with each other. They figure out ways to exchange information. They avoid duplication of services. You know, even though I'm a physician who specializes in cleft lip and cleft palate, if you walked into my office and my medical assistant took your blood pressure, it was elevated, I would recognize it's not normal. And I can communicate with your clinician and we could control your blood pressure there and then, or as soon as you got home, where the doctor would do a phone call or a telemedicine type visit. We have all these opportunities that start to be created once we move into this capitated world that simply don't exist in what I think of as a 19th century cottage industry of American medicine. It's fragmented. Rather than doctors working together as one that's separated across the community, it's paid on this piecemeal fee-for-service basis, uses technology left over from the last century, although in reality, it's the century before, as the most common way that doctors communicate is the fax machine, an 1834 invention. And there's no one with the ability to make this change happen. So increasingly, what I'm looking at, Bob, is how do I help insurers, hospitals, and clinicians to come together and recognize that if we can make this move from fee-for-service to capitation, if we can embed within it a generative AI tool, both for the clinician and for the patient, if we can focus on opportunities around prevention and opportunities around better chronic disease management, that we can lower heart attack, strokes, kidney failure, cancer, 30 to 50%, dropping healthcare costs, raising health, raising longevity. When I look out there, this is a remarkable advance. We're going to look back and say, this was the turning point of American medicine if we do it right.
Yeah, you talked about your friend Ben in the book who had a just horrific experience on his healthcare journey. And it reminds me of this YouTube that we show our students quite often. It's called If Air Travel Worked Like Healthcare. And it's a parody. It's really funny to watch that. But they talk about the fax machines and all the antiquated things that we still use in the healthcare world. But the biggest problem you've pointed out is the people problem. And we talk about the triad of the union of a doctor and the patient and the AI tools. Remember the Khan Academy, they flipped the model upside down, doing the homework differently, not doing it at home, but learning in a different way, engaging in a different way. How do we go about making this change happen? Change is not easy, but it involves these three things: the doctor, the patient, and the AI tools. What's the advice that you can give people today that need to consider this as a new approach?
Well, I'm glad you brought up the Khan Academy because it is, I see it as a model for how we could use this tool to address acute problems. And by that, I mean that if you have some new symptoms, well, let me backtrack a little bit for people who may not know the Khan Academy. Rather than going to a class, hearing a lecture, going home and doing homework, the night before you watch a video, you learn about the topic, you do your homework. When you come to class, you're able to have a detailed discussion. Same thing, I think, in medicine. If you're having symptoms, you can use a generative AI tool. And I talk about ChatGPT, but it can be Gemini by Google. It can be Claude by Anthropic. We have a lot of different tools that are out there. They're all very similar. And you can research it and you can figure out what's wrong. And then when you come to the clinician, you can have a more in-depth conversation. And I think that that's the way to start thinking about the evolved doctor-patient relationship. Mm-hmm. It's no longer the patient coming in with no expertise. The patient comes in with expertise, not like the Google knowledge where you have 100 pages of printout, half of which is unrelated to your problem, and no one wants to see all that. This is very clear. It's almost like a second opinion. Diagnosis of what the problem is and the treatment that's recommended. And now the clinician can go into greater depth in the time that's available and be able to help you to adhere to it more directly. So I think this is going to be part of this new era. What's it going to take? Well, clinicians are going to have to feel comfortable empowering patients. They're going to have to create the ability to have tools. I'm hoping the national societies will do it. Not every doc should figure it out. We could have links. We could have handouts. We could have videos on YouTube. There's all the different ways that we can educate patients about how to use the Gen AI. And we know that when it comes to Gen AI, if you don't put the right prompts in place, if you don't do the right follow-up, you're not going to get the right answer. So we can educate patients and build that into our thinking about whether it's a new problem, about whether it's an ongoing problem. And I think we'll also have tools to support us in the interim. I mean, take mental health as an example. You know, we see someone in mental health and maybe we see them back in 2 weeks. What happens during those 2 weeks? We have no idea. Now we have that ability to be able to monitor them. Think about hospital at home. You know, we often keep people in the hospital because we want to monitor them. We're afraid something will go wrong. Now we can monitor them and use telemedicine to be able to intervene immediately. In fact, earlier, because we recognize a problem, not when it hit a crisis, an emergency or a cardiac arrest, but when things were heading in the wrong direction, we would pick it up sooner. It would make the job of the nurse better. I don't know if you've been in a hospital, but I've been in there several times for badly broken bones. And the nurse comes by at 8 o'clock in the morning, comes back 4 hours later at noon. What happens in between the time? We don't know. And this is, I think, going to be a tremendous opportunity that exists. And it's even more than that. I think the other thing to realize is that all those bedside monitors that sit in every hospital room, they generate a total of what's called a petabyte of data. That's a 10, with 14 zeros after it of data, 97% of which we throw away.
Yeah.
Imagine how much we could learn, because we can connect that with the electronic record, with the laboratory results. This is, as I say, this is the dawn of the era. This is still my dad locking that iPhone in the trunk of his car. That's how we're thinking about it. I believe that we need to be looking ahead 5 years and getting ready for it, making those changes. I just believe that it will be central to medicine if we have the desire and ability and courage to be able to make the changes that are needed in how we finance health systems, how we organize health systems, and how we evaluate them.
So Robbie, it's real clear to me that you're in the business of creating physician leaders. The next generation of doctors, they need to know what you know. They need to know the technology. They need more ability and skills. I recently visited the Kaiser Medical School, the new one there in Pasadena, and they've got a new model. But none of that matters if you don't have leadership. And in your book, we won't have time to cover all of this, but you share with us your A to G leadership model. And we won't go over that now, but A, B, C, D, E, F, G, aspirational, behavior, context, data, engagement, faculty, and governance. And that is such a key component. That really is a sine qua non of the whole story, is having the leadership engaged like that. So any final words from you as we wrap up?
My final thought is that everyone in this nation, particularly all the listeners of this podcast, if for whatever reason they've not tried the technology, this is the time to do so. Take your last medical encounter or wait till you have your next one. Put all the information in place and see how the advice comes along. Put information about all your various diseases and see what kind of information and recommendations. Getting a sense of how powerful this is. And as I said, it's going to be 32 times more powerful into the future. I think that we have to accept, and I'm sure you saw the Commonwealth Fund report that just came out called Mirror, Mirror 2024. Of the 10, I'll say, most advanced nations in the world, the U.S. is last in every category except cost, where we lead by far, charging over $13,000 per American, with Switzerland at 9 and Germany at 7 and everyone else at half what we charge. Our life expectancy lags by 5 to 6 years. Maternal mortality is double any other nation. Pediatric mortality is significantly higher. We have to accept that despite the fact that we have some of the smartest doctors in the world, that they're extremely well-trained, that what we do today isn't working. And I don't believe in pointing fingers. I look at finding solutions. And I think we need to recognize that generative AI is the tool. And it's the tool that could save hundreds of thousands of lives by avoiding misdiagnoses, by being able to avoid medical errors, by being able to empower patients to better manage chronic disease. We can lower the cost of medicine, not by compromising care, but by improving the opportunities that sit right in front of us are massive. I would encourage those in medicine to pursue leadership, as you say, because if we can't overcome people's fears and concerns, if we can't help people to implement this technology effectively, it will fail. And I think that for anyone who is pessimistic about the American healthcare system today, I encourage you to read the book. Let me know your thoughts around it, because I believe that generative AI will be the tool that allows us to transform American medicine and make it once again the best in the world.
Well, Robbie, thank you for all you're doing. Thank you for ChatGPT MD. We are using it in our textbook this fall in our Alliance for Physician Leadership program at the University of Texas, Dallas. We've been developing physician leaders there for 25 years. So I'm going to encourage everyone to get a copy. I personally buy it in two formats. I get it in Kindle so I can research, and I get it in Audible so I can enjoy it on my run. It's great to know that all the proceeds go to Doctors Without Borders. That's so great. Thank you for that.
Thank you so much for having me today.
Thanks for listening today. If you have any questions or want to hear from a specific guest, contact us at gopi.com. That's G-O-P-I, gopi.com. Be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcasting app to make sure you don't miss any of our episodes.